May it please the court, my name is John Lesser. I'm appearing here today on behalf of the coal shipper petitioners, who are the Western Coal Traffic League, Western Fuels Association, Basin Electric Power Cooperative, and AEP Texas North. I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. Coal shippers have asked this court to take four actions in connection with the decision under review. First, we ask the court to vacate the board's decision adopting a new average total cost, or ATC, method for setting crossover traffic divisions under the board's standalone cost constraint. Secondly, we've asked the court to vacate the board's decision to utilize only unadjusted costs in making jurisdictional threshold determinations in large rate cases. Third, we've asked the court to vacate the board's decision to adopt a new hybrid index to forecast standalone railroad operating expenses over the new 10-year discounted cash flow period. Finally, we've asked the court to vacate the board's decision to retroactively apply the new ATC methodology in the pending Western Fuels case. And we've raised a number of arguments in support of our requests, and in the time I have here, I'd like to hit a few high points. On ATC, the issue is whether this new ATC method complies with the coal rate guidelines. The board maintains that it does. Coal shippers disagree. Our position is that the ATC method deviates from the guidelines in two significant respects. First, ATC is a fully allocated cost methodology, and the coal rate guidelines make very clear that fully allocated cost methodology should play no role in the establishment of maximum reasonable rates. The guidelines were set up in response to fully allocated cost standards that the Interstate Commerce Commission had used prior to 1985 and uniformly rejected, which is why they adopted the constrained market pricing approach in the guidelines. ATC interjects into the maximum rate process exactly what the guidelines say shouldn't be there, the use of a fully allocated cost mechanism. We've also put in some extensive arguments on the fact that ATC is a cost-based methodology, and we believe the coal rate guidelines is authoritatively construed by both the ICC and the STB prior to 2003, called for the use of a market standard in developing crossover traffic.
Why can't the board depart, though? Why can't the board change its approach? I mean, this is something that administrative agencies should do, learn from experience, change their approach.
I think the answer on the fully allocated cost methodology is the board doesn't acknowledge that it's changing its position. It says that ATC is not a fully allocated cost mechanism, and clearly it is. On the market
if
point,
they'd acknowledge that, would you say it's okay?
No. But the point is they haven't acknowledged it. I think they'd have to acknowledge it and to
why wouldn't it be okay if they'd acknowledged it?
I think it was a basic precept that the guidelines were based on, that you couldn't use a fully allocated cost mechanism.
So once the guidelines, is out there, that have to adhere to that forever?
I think they have to adhere to until they provide a rational explanation as to why they're not. And we came in and said ATC is a fully allocated cost mechanism. All the parties in the proceeding below acknowledged that you should not use a fully allocated cost mechanism to set maximum reasonable rates. I think even the board would agree with that. And our point was you were interjecting into the maximum rate process exactly what you said you shouldn't be doing. So it's a very fundamental point. But the point is they didn't acknowledge it. I think I'll move along, given the short time here, off of crossover traffic divisions to unadjusted costs. We submit that the board erred in deciding only unadjusted costs should be used in making jurisdictional threshold determinations. The board's decision overturns 26 years of consistent contrary precedent issued by the ICC and the STB. And the board decides to abandon the use of adjusted cost using a cost-benefit analysis that we submit was arbitrary and capricious. The board says that the cost of developing movement-specific adjustments is high, and the benefits achieved from the invocation of these costs is low. We believe that both prongs are arbitrary. On the cost side, the cost of developing movement-specific adjustments pales in comparison to the cost of developing standalone costs. The cost of developing standalone costs in these cases now is up to $5 or $6 million. While it does, you do incur some expense in calculating variable costs, it's not a huge component in the cost of these cases. We believe it was arbitrary for the board to fixate on this one actually lower cost component rather than looking at some other things if it was going to apply a cost-benefit analysis. But more importantly, the single most important calculation that can be made in a standalone case, in certain cases, is the calculation of these variable costs. For example, if the standalone cost for a movement is less than the jurisdictional threshold, the board will set the maximum rate at the jurisdictional threshold. Given the importance of the jurisdictional threshold in the overall standalone cost scheme, we submit it was arbitrary for the board to exclude a whole set of relevant evidence in making this determination. We submit that the board got it right for the past 26 years prior to the decision below, and its decision to move in a different direction was arbitrary. On the third issue, the so-called hybrid index, which is an index composed of two indices published by the STB, the so-called RCAFA, and the RCAFU. We agree with the board as basic premise that productivity should be included in the forecast of standalone operating cost changes. We believe, however, the board made two errors, and the two errors involve the board's failure to meaningfully address evidence the coal shippers submitted that a standalone railroad would achieve substantial productivity improvements in its first year of operation. And also the board ignored substantial evidence that the phase-in period for productivity, which the board set at 20 years, should be 10 years. In the interest of time.
Well, what did you think it should be?
We thought it should be 10 years.
Left where it was.
Wait, I'm sorry?
It was not where it was before.
No, there was no phase-in.
They went to 20 years. This is this is the quantum that's phased in 5% a year?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So what do you suggest they do? Go back to 10? I mean, go to 10?
To go to 10.
Why 10?
And the reason we selected 10 was the board chose 20 years on the theory it would take 20 years for the railroad industry to catch up in terms of its productivity with the standalone railroad. Our experts submitted substantial evidence based upon financial reports that the railroads file at the STB that the railroad industry as a whole is rolling over its assets at 7-year increments. So
now the board said that some rolling stock is leased for 20 years.
Right.
So how do you turn it over every 7 years?
Well, if the rolling stock is leased and somebody thinks that they can do better by doing something else, they can get out, they buy out of the lease. That's very common in the railroad industry.
So you have evidence that although people enter into 20-year leases, they're actually terminating them after an average of 7 years?
The average from the financial data that's at the board says 7 years, whether it involves a particular lease or not, I don't know. In some of the individual cases, expert witnesses have come in and explained how railroad equipment leases work, and the fact that if a newer model railroad or newer model locomotive comes around, and we're, I guess I'm out of time.
Well, go ahead. We'll give you offsetting time. Go
ahead. Okay. And these are usually unit train movements, and they use state-of-the-art equipment. And if a better locomotive comes around, you buy out of the lease or work with the lessor. So there's a secondary market for folks that aren't quite as interested in having the state-of-the-art as the coal shippers. And you buy out, and you get the new locomotive.
But there's substantial evidence for that. Doesn't really go to the question, which is whether there's substantial evidence for what the board did.
I believe the board picked its number out of the hat. I mean, I think the board, as much as acknowledges the 20 year, it's just
they did reference the 20-year lease practice.
Right, and that's the lease of locomotives is just one small component of the overall railroad asset.
Well, the rolling stock as a whole is going to turn over faster than a road bed, isn't it?
Well, I guess it depends. If you're up in the Powder River Basin where they're replacing, you know, tracked or double tracking, triple tracking, things of that nature, you know, I think it depends on the situation.
Isn't any number they pick here going to be arbitrary in some
sense? I think the board's standard was they were attempting to try to determine how long it would take the railroad industry as a whole to catch up with the standalone railroad. So the question is, what's that number?
Right, but the railroad industry as a whole, not the most intensive users, which are probably your movements out of the Powder River Basin.
Right. I would believe that our assets would actually...
I understand that, but they're promulgating one standard for the entire industry.
Well, most of the guidelines, basically, while they apply to all large shippers, have been exclusively used, with one or two exceptions over the past 20 years, in coal rate cases. At one time, these were called the coal rate guidelines. I've used up all my time, and I haven't addressed the last issue.
Well, let me see, why is it that these guidelines are not used outside of, you know, for other movements?
I believe the cost of presenting these cases is so high that the only ones left that can bear it are the electric utilities that have so much money involved. And as a practical matter, unless you have a unit train movement that cycles in circles that's going over high density lines, these guidelines, either the old version or the new version, just don't work.
Okay. We'll give you 2 minutes back, okay, for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
What had you tried to reserve?
I reserved one and missed one issue, so maybe I'll talk about
that. Give you the two. It's a bonus.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sam Sipe. I'm here today as counsel for BNSF Railway, one of the railroad petitioners, and I'm going to be arguing on behalf of all the railroad petitioners on two of the issues addressed in our briefs. The first and most important issue in this case, we believe, and I believe the board concurs, is the new rate prescription methodology. I'm also briefly going to address the issue you were just discussing with Mr. Lesser, the productivity issue. The board is described as the centerpiece of this rulemaking, its adoption of a new rate prescription methodology in standalone cost rate cases. The petitioning railroads believe that in adopting this methodology, the board has departed from its longstanding commitment to demand-based pricing, which is the cornerstone of railroad rate making under the Staggers Act and the cornerstone of the guidelines. In its decision under review, the STB made its first changes in 22 years to its standards for determining rate reasonableness. Those standards had been in place since the guidelines were adopted in 1985. The rulemaking was intended to refine the implementation of guidelines. The board did not set out to replace guidelines with an alternative rate-making methodology, but the decision at issue effectively makes the guidelines meaningless by repudiating the reliance on demand-based pricing. And in effect, what it says
is... said they were going to do that. Would that be okay? Same question to you.
No, it wouldn't be okay if they said they were going to do that unless they replaced the guidelines with a coherent, economically sound rate standard that was based on the statute. On remand, they could go back and attempt to do it. I think they would have a very steep hill to climb to
replace. When you say based on the statute, what terms in the statute?
Reasonable? Judge Kavanaugh, we rely on several interrelated provisions of the statute. First of all, the provision of national transportation policy to allow competition and the demand for rail services to determine rates to the maximum extent possible. That's exactly what guidelines talks about.
Isn't it precisely on feasibility that the board justified its change of direction?
On feasibility?
Mm-hmm.
The feasibility of implementing an alternative approach?
The feasibility of refining something that looks more like Ramsey pricing.
They didn't try very hard to find an alternative to Ramsey pricing beyond the approach that they had used in the past.
And this, right, they were having difficulties with that, correct?
I don't think they made a serious effort to look at it here, Your Honor. If you go back to the original notice of proposed rulemaking, what they said in that decision was, we think our new proposed rate-setting approach will be consistent with Ramsey pricing and differential pricing. And then by the time they got to the decision, they backed off of that. If the notice of proposed rulemaking had said, after these 22 years, we have some serious reservations as to whether full-scale commitment to differential pricing is now appropriate in this industry, and we're going to explore whether an alternative framework would work, then the parties would have submitted comments addressed to that issue. Is there a viable alternative framework that comports with the statute?
That seems to be a different argument. That's an argument that the final rule departed too much from the NPRM.
It was not a logical outgrowth.
Yeah.
That is a fair comment, Judge Kavanaugh. And I think where we are today and where I would be happy to stay is focused on what they did wrong. But obviously there are implications about what they did wrong for what they might do on remand. And it seemed like we were heading there. In any event, I believe the court will acknowledge or has recognized that the guidelines are grounded in the economic logic of Ramsey pricing, which provides for the recovery of unattributable cost by pricing in response to perceived demand. And the agency in guidelines said, we expect to see railroads set their rates based on shipper demand. And the statute says railroads in the first instance may set any rate they choose. Now, of course, that is subject to rate reasonableness review in the case of a market dominant carrier. But in the first instance, the railroad gets to set the rate based on perceived demand.
Is BNSF dominant out of Powder River Basin?
As to some shippers, Your Honor, we have been found to be dominant because we are the sole serving carrier on the receiving end. Union Pacific also serves the Powder River Basin, and there are probably more movements that are duly served, both at origin and destination, by BNSF Railway and Union Pacific. But on some, Burlington Northern is the sole carrier at destination.
And UP on some?
And UP on some. And these rate cases that the court is familiar with, these coal rate cases are ones in which we are the BNSF is the sole serving carrier at the destination. When the board first adopted the guidelines, it said, if we find that there's been a violation of the SAC test, that is, if the revenues exceed costs for the discounted cash flow period, then we will prescribe a rate, and we will prescribe a rate based on Ramsey principles, which means we will try to take carrier demand as reflected in the existing rate structure into account. That was the genesis of this whole percentage rate methodology, which had been in place for over 15 years and which concededly worked well to produce Ramsey-like results.
Well, the board expressed concern with gaming the system.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That the starting out rates were manipulated.
Our fundamental position in this case is that even if the board had provided a reasoned basis for believing that gaming was a problem that could only be cured by this kind of blanket presumption, even if they had done that, it would have been impermissible to adopt this MMM methodology that throws differential pricing out the window. However, we also believe that the board's explanation as to gaming is not coherent, They said, setting a rate higher than the level that you think you're going to come out with at the end of a rate proceeding is gaming the system. If, in fact, the rate you set is based on the perceived demand for the traffic and is commercially sustainable, that is, it doesn't drive traffic off your railroad, how could that be gaming? The board didn't give a...
If I recall the point, it was that if the going-in rate is higher than what they later determined to be the reasonable rate, under the current system, the reduction of rates will fall somewhat arbitrarily, even on rates, well, that the higher you set the going-in rate, the better off you will be after the reduction.
If the whole idea of the rate-making scheme is that you're supposed to price captive traffic based on your perception of the demand for the traffic, and if you believe that captive traffic will sustain a high rate, then you're supposed to charge a high rate. The fact that it turns out to be unreasonably high doesn't mean, in retrospect, you should be deemed to have gamed the system. We presented testimony from two experts who are very familiar with this industry, and one of whom, Professor Willig, was an author whose work was relied on in adopting the guidelines, who said, listen, board, you need to distinguish between a circumstance in which the carrier is pricing in accordance with the demand it perceives versus the circumstance in which the carrier is setting a rate that exceeds a commercially sustainable rate. If you do the latter in the expectation that the agency will cut you back and you'll end up in the zone where you want to be, that's clearly driven only by litigation tactics, not by a sense of what you'd like to achieve in the marketplace. If you set a high rate...
Are you saying that any rate that the traffic will bear, therefore, is a reasonable rate?
No, not a reasonable rate.
Okay.
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that in a circumstance where that high rate is challenged and is found to be unreasonable, the board still has to adhere to the precept of taking account of demand when it prescribes the maximum reasonable rate. And if the railroad has not set a commercially unsustainable rate at the outset, then the board can't punish it under the logic of its own guidelines for having set an unreasonable rate. I mean, can't punish it any more than saying this rate's unreasonable. Of course, there has to be a cap. The question here is, how is that cap arrived at? I realize I'm out of time and I haven't had a chance to address the productivity issue.
Why don't you take a minute and do that?
I believe Judge Kavanaugh got it right when he said, isn't any number, and I'm not purporting to give an exact quote, but the thrust of what I heard you say, isn't any number that the board might select here to phase in productivity arbitrary? And the answer is yes, and I think the board's position here is, look, this is an easy way to do it. We've got a problem here. We think there's going to be some productivity down the road. We don't know how much it's going to be. We can't quantify it. Let's pick a number. Let's think of the model of straight line depreciation and, you know, phase it in at 5% a year. That is arbitrary, and we suggested that the proper approach in these cases, even though it involves some more work, is for the shippers to submit evidence projecting specific kinds of productivity gains that they believe a standalone railroad, which is by definition the most efficient railroad that could be constructed when it's constructed, what that railroad might achieve in the way of productivity over the first few years. Put in evidence saying what kind of technological changes that are on the horizon are available to this railroad, and that wouldn't be necessarily long-lived assets. it might be near-term assets. The example in the record was computers. Okay, you might go out and buy some computers and improve your productivity, but you would incur a capital cost if you did that.
This would be that'd be an enormously time-consuming exercise, and I think what the board's trying to do, as I read the board's decision, is to find a number that is within the range of reasonableness, taking into account the competing arguments, and picking a number within that range of reasonableness is necessarily has some arbitrariness to it, but it's rooted in a reasonable analysis of the competing positions. What's wrong with that?
I would say that is a fair characterization of the board's objective, but what I would say, Judge Kavanaugh, is given how much is at stake in these cases, it's not inappropriate to require the parties to put in some evidence on an issue like
Thank you, Mr. Seifert.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think I wanted to reserve a minute. Not sure I said it.
Had we but time, Will's enough in time. We'll give you the minute, Mr. Seifert. Rosenthal.
My name is Michael Rosenthal. I'm counsel for Union Pacific, but I'm speaking on behalf of all of the railroad petitioners except for BNSF Railway. I've not reserved any time for rebuttal. I will briefly address the railroad perspective
you
on
use both of your minutes right now.
This is both of my minutes. This is it. I'm going to briefly address the railroad perspective on adjustments to variable costs. The board calls its Uniform Rail Costing Railroad Costing System, or URCS. In the proceeding below, both the railroads and shippers agreed that the board had gone too far in proposing to prohibit all adjustments to IRCs. Unlike the shippers, however, the railroads proposed alternatives to an all-or-nothing approach, and most significantly, railroads proposed allowing a limited number of adjustments. The board didn't dispute that the data required to make these adjustments, primarily data on actual train operations and payments to third parties, were readily available and routinely agreed upon.
But they gave an explanation as to why they rejected that. Said it was biased,
the
and
board,
it would distort.
That's right. The boards agreed that the data were easily obtained. They can't dispute that their original decision adopting this IRC system contemplated these adjustments, and they can't dispute that their computer program actually allows for many of these adjustments. But they said that they were biased. They said that piecemeal adjustments were suspect, that the railroad proposals would tend to bias results in favor of railroads, but they never supported those assertions with any reasoned analysis. They never explained, for example, how it was biased or suspect not to account for payments to third parties, which the board acknowledged were legitimate variable costs and were not otherwise accounted for by IRCs. They never explained how it was suspect or biased to use data on actual train operations. The IRCs program uses some actual data, such as the number of rail cars and the tons of freight per car. So why not account for the number of locomotives actually used to move those cars? The board did say that using the data would actually benefit railroads, but if data show that certain traffic is more costly than system average traffic, how is accounting for those costs biased? And that's what the board didn't explain. The board didn't explain why what the actual data showed would be biased. I realize I'm.
Are there further questions on this?
Thank you.
Before we hear from the government, we'll take a brief recess.
Stand, please. This audible court will now take a brief recess. Thank you.
Stand, please. This honorable court is again in session. Be seated, please.
Mr. Atkins.
May it please the court, Raymond Atkins representing the Surface Transportation Board and the United States Government. Joining me is Mr. John Fonte from the Department of Justice.
Rather than have you traverse every issue in this raised in the briefs or even in the oral argument, I'd like to focus your attention on a few matters, on however many matters coming from the court. And I will start by, I'll let Judge Kavanaugh start considering his focus.
On the MMM issue, argument from the railroads is that this really throws demand-based pricing out. Can you respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor, and it does not throw demand-based differential pricing out. I would direct Your Honors to pages, the Joint Appendix 558 through 556, where the board quite clearly announced that it was retaining the core policy of demand-based differential pricing, and MMM satisfies that requirement. The way the MMM works, and you can see the graph on the next page. Look at page 558 of the Joint Appendix. This is in the board's decision. There's an elaborate discussion here about how this approach is consistent with demand-based differential pricing, which the railroads entirely ignore. They're equating Ramsey pricing with differential pricing. Demand-based differential pricing is satisfied here. This is what MMM does, Your Honor. It leaves all the rates, the low-rated traffic rates, untouched.
And 558?
585, my apologies, Your Honor.
Okay.
585. Okay. We're looking at page 21 of the decision. You can see the chart there where it sets forth the MMM. Really, all that this approach is doing is it's capping the markup that the railroads are permitted to charge. They can differentially price to their heart's content within that framework, up to a maximum. And that maximum is being set specifically at the point where the railroads are earning enough money from the traffic group to cover the SAC costs. And the SAC costs, Your Honors, are the amount of money that the railroads need to earn adequate revenue. So that's sort of the first part of the inquiry. The next part is, how do you set the cap? And MMM is designed to account for demand-based differential pricing by permitting differential pricing, but up to a point. And then at that point, there is no more demand-based differential pricing permitted by the board, which is appropriate because the board's role is to set the maximum lawful rate. And when you set a rate, of course, it means you can't price above it, which is going to limit the amount of demand-based differential pricing above that point. But there's the approach is consistent with guidelines. It's consistent with the core policy of the statute, which is what the board found when it analyzed this
consistent
issue.
Consistent with guidelines? I thought this was a refinement or departure.
It is a departure from guidelines in one important respect, which is it's not following Ramsey pricing principles. But it's consistent with guidelines because it follows the core principle of the statute, which is to permit demand-based differential pricing. Now, on the point of whether or not the party should have been aware of the board's intent, perhaps to depart from Ramsey pricing, let me give you the history of how this evolved. We had a series of serious allegations that the existing approach was subject to manipulation. The board was looking for an alternative that would be consistent with.
For allegations, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And the board could not distinguish between rate increases that were commercially sustainable and rate increases that were designed to manipulate the outcome. It had no means of detecting it, and it was clear that the railroads could engage in gaming. They have never denied that the loophole was there. They've just claimed that they've never taken advantage of it. So the board was looking for an alternative, and the shippers were trying to provide one. And in the Excel case, they offered one up, but that was not consistent with Ramsey pricing. And this is what the board wrote in the Excel case just before this rulemaking. It may be there is good reason to depart from Ramsey pricing principles in this regard, but to make such a momentous change within the context of a particular adjudication seems ill-advised. And then it went on to conclude that it would not be appropriate to set aside the underlying Ramsey pricing principles without notice and comment and an opportunity for all those to be affected to hear. It then proposed for public comment the exact proposal that Excel was offering. And then when the Western Coal Traffic League said, don't do a rulemaking, if you look at the Joint Appendix at 63 at your leisure, you'll see that the board said, we're doing a rulemaking because some of the changes need notice and comment, and then it cited the language I just quoted in Excel. So the idea that they weren't on notice, or this wasn't a logical outgrowth, the rule that the board adopted was precisely the rule that it noticed for federal in its rulemaking. So it has to be a logical outgrowth that the board would adopt it. The board, when it was searching for an alternative to the percent rate reduction, It also realized there's a second equally compelling reason to have a departure from guidelines and set aside Ramsey pricing principles. And that's because of a conflict between Ramsey pricing and the basic statutory framework. Ramsey pricing assumes that every rate in the traffic group is unreasonably high, whether it's got a markup of 110, a little modest markup, or it's got a staggering markup of 1,000%. But, Your Honors, there's an unrebuttable presumption in the statute that competitive rates are reasonable. Congress was not worried about those rates being too high. In fact, they were worried about them being too low. So with the long canon factors, it directed the agency to give due consideration to whether or not carriers are first getting as much money as they can from the competitive traffic before they turn to captive traffic to earn the rest. But that's a conflict. Ramsey pricing is saying those rates are too high. The statute is saying those rates are fine. In those circumstances, the board must resolve any such conflict in favor of the statute. And so their core complaint on appeal is that MMM does not permit demand-based differential pricing. The board expressly addressed that issue at length, and they've offered no reason for you to set aside the agency's judgment on that question.
All right, what about the movement-specific adjustment argument?
Movement-specific adjustments is the board acknowledged that this was a departure from longstanding precedent. And let me explain first what ERCS does, just to make sure that you're aware that it does actually tailor the model to the particulars of the movement. It's just not as many adjustments as the parties might like. But the board,
that's the explanation then that's up at, I think, 609, where in response to the shippers, talking about these, register some productivity change.
Would you want to do productivity, Your Honor?
No, I want to stick with movement-specific adjustment for jurisdictional.
Right, which is the board's decision and an analysis of this is set forth starting at page 614 and running through. It runs for quite some time. Where let me try to explain the considerations the board took in balancing and where it reached its outcome. First, the board was exploring what was the purpose of the 180. And when it looked at the legislative history of when it was put in place in 1980, it was clear that the Congress was intending this to be a clear threshold test, a threshold test designed to replace or to supplement the amorphous market dominance inquiry. Then, no one challenges the fact that the movement-specific adjustments have grown into a very expensive endeavor. The evidence on this record was it cost each party $1 million, or roughly one-third of the cost of a SAC case. So the board then just balanced those burdens and Congress's intent with what kind of improved accuracy was it getting. And it had some reservations that it was just getting a different number, not actually getting an approved result. Why? Well, first of all, the railroads had the incentive to selectively keep the data that was favorable to their adjustments but not favorable to the shippers' adjustments. And that's creating an asymmetry that would bias the outcome. Second, parties were making adjustments to certain costs without making an adjustment to the variability parameter. And I'm hopeful that we describe that in sufficient detail in our briefs to let you understand what that meant. But it's an apples and oranges comparison. You can't be taking the hard number and then not adjusting the variability. And so that brought a number of other adjustments into question. And then on top of that, it was concerned about just sort of selectively pulling at threads of ERCS without considering the whole ripple effect. And so what the board said was, we're going to use our ERCS model. It's our uniform rail costing system designed for all regulatory costing purposes. And when it addressed the particulars of the little pet adjustments that the railroads wanted, it said two things. It said, first of all, it's obviously unfair to just permit the pet adjustments of the railroads without letting the shippers have any opportunity for any countervailing adjustments. That's going to create bias. But then it went on to say, you know, the railroads, if there's some additional adjustment you want added to the list of movement-specific adjustments that are already in ERCS, like locomotives or third-party payments or whatever your adjustment is, just come to the board, ask us to modify the ERCS program. We'll do it in a broad rulemaking context so they'll get public comment, and then it will be applied uniformly, which is the point of a uniform rail costing system. And so the board believed what it did was prudent. And keeping in mind, Your Honor, an overarching concern that threads throughout the entire rulemaking. The board had been hearing an outcry from the general rail community that these guidelines had become so expensive and time-consuming that they were available only to a select few coal shippers. And the board is the guardian of the public interest. They have to try to make sure that this approach is not limited to just coal shippers. It should be available to all captive shippers. Indeed, when the guidelines were first approved by the Third Circuit, Judge Becker wrote a separate concurring opinion where he expressed serious reservations about the SAC test. He wasn't concerned about the theory of it, which is sound. He was worried that in application it was going to become so expensive it was going to deny shippers access. And what he noted was, you know, the Interstate Commerce Act is not adopted to be the full employment bill for economists. And it told the agency, you must be vigilant not to let costs overwhelm. And so that's what the board was doing here. And its decision there was reasonable. How about the hybrid A, hybrid, yes, Your Honor.
Now, next, I'd like to take up the lack of any productivity adjustment for the first year.
For the the base year, Your Honor, as opposed to having it start in year two? Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's the objection, right?
Yeah, what you mean, this inquiry is difficult. It's like counting the number of angels that dance on the head of a pin. Now we're splitting hairs over whether it starts at the year zero or year one, whether we put 0.1% of productivity in year one or it's 0.5% of one. But anyways, the board's this is incremental, Your Honor. We start the productivity at the beginning of year two, mm-hmm. and then a little bit more in year three, and a little bit more in year four. And if they're complaining that we should have started at day zero, the board's point is those are the base year operating expenses. That's the base that we're trying to index. We don't want to then lower the base down for productivity. And so it thought this was a reasonable approach, was to start with the base year and then to increment it over time. And
what is the amount in year two?
It'll be 1/5 or 5% of whatever the industry average is, which is roughly 2%. So the first year,
if that were moved forward into year one,
it would have a small incremental effect on the overall SAC analysis, Your Honor. But again, the board was thinking that when it goes out and it develops these base year operating expenses, it's based on all of these, what's known at the time in terms of the operations of, you know, there's no learning by doing. I mean, it's a base year calculation. How much does it cost to own and operate this railroad in, say, year 2000? And then the question is, how do you forecast it forward? But the board didn't think it was appropriate to then take the base year and lower it even further as a result of hypothetical productivity improvements. It thought the better recourse was just to smooth it in, starting in the second year and then the third year and so forth. In terms of how the convergence would take place, you can tell the board was struggling with this problem because could it take place at year 19 or year 23? Sure. The board was trying to get a workable approach that it could use in lieu of what the railroads were quite satisfied with, put the burden on the shipper because they can never satisfy it. Because productivity, hypothetical future productivity, is an unknown. If we knew it now, it wouldn't be future productivity, it'd be current productivity. And so the board was just trying to come up with a reasonable result that falls within a reasonable range, and it based it on certain basic principles. The first basic principle was that even this hypothetical railroad will see some productivity in the early years. Mm-hmm. And there was lots of evidence about if you even have any new plant that gets constructed will see some learning by doing and some modest productivity. And the question is how long?
Pretty modest.
Yes, right. It is modest, Your Honor. But right. This is, keep in mind, this is a optimally designed, hypothetically efficient railroad. So it shouldn't be seeing a ton of productivity, not like the railroad industry, which is still struggling with, you know, a legacy of excessive lines, it still needs to prune it, it's got a, you know, this hypothetical railroad starts with brand new equipment. I mean, its locomotives are brand new, its rail cars are all brand new. So even if 2 years out a new locomotive comes along that's better, the railroads are going to see more productivity from that because they're going to swap it out with some 20-year-old locomotive, whereas the SAR wouldn't be able to swap it out with, you know, we would have a very brand new locomotive. It would be like, you know, replacing our cars. If I bought it 2 years ago, the newer cars aren't that much different, but if I'm driving around in a 1970 Chevy, you know, that's a significant difference in terms of productivity. So what
is the only evidence about the 20-year leases?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. In terms of picking the 20-year, the board expressed its judgment based on leases, and it had two other concerns that really weren't quantifiable, which also supported a long-term horizon, and that is the idea that the railroad industry's productivity, part of that is from pruning excess lines. And so you don't want to, you can't give the SAR the same productivity because there's no indication the SAR is going to be pruning any access lines over the DCF period. And so the board was thinking that you need to, when is the railroad industry going to come down and start to look more like the SAR in terms of excess capacity and pruning lines? And it was thinking long term, something like 20 years. Again, it's a rough call. The board appreciates that any rule has sort of imprecise application when you apply it to particular circumstances. But sometimes you need a workable rule that avoids the expense of individualized evidence, and the board concluded that such an approach was necessary here.
But the only evidence is the fact that some leases are written for 20 years.
Well, the leases in these SAC cases for the rail cars and locomotives tend to be 20 years long, yes, Your Honor. So it's going to take a sort of a full replacement cycle before.
But if it's true that that typically the leases terminate after 7 years.
Okay, let me address the seven. I don't recall seeing any evidence that rail leases typically end in 7 years. And we have lots of SAC cases, and the leases are all 20 years long, and they keep using the same locomotives for the entirety of the SAC analysis period. The 7 years.
Isn't it a little bit like saying, well, look, home mortgages are written for 20 and 30 years, so we'll use that, when in fact we know that the average home mortgage terminates in 7 years.
Yes, Your Honor, and so maybe there will be some slow incremental replacement of locomotives over that time period, but that still doesn't mean you use a short time period, because you want the mix of locomotives of the SAR to look like the mix of locomotives of the railroad industry. So if you think about where does productivity come from, the railroads.
The industry, not of the out of the Powder River Basin.
That's right, because the RCAF number is an industry-wide number. So the RCAF prediction of productivity is not specific to coal unit trains. It's a industry-wide number. So that's why
Does it in practice get applied? Are there these kinds of proceedings outside of coal movements?
Well, if we had other rate cases, the RCAF routinely gets applied to non-coal traffic. It's used in the industry and all kinds. It's embedded in all sorts of contracts. It's a industry-wide. It's like the producer price index, but it's for tailored for railroad industry.
Now, I gather the shippers put in as a fact that the average age of rolling stock is indeed 7 years.
You'll find that fact buried in one statement by one expert citing a report that they didn't submit to the agency. And so it's not that the support underlying that wasn't before the agency, which is probably why the agency didn't address it in its decision. And then when I looked, Mike Baranowski for the railroad said that's a flawed analysis because there's some purchase accounting problems with the way they performed that analysis, and shippers never responded in rebuttal. So the board's failure to address a tiny bit of evidence in the broader rulemaking shouldn't provide a basis to set aside what is otherwise a reasoned decision. Finally, let me turn to the average total cost approach. I don't know if Your Honor recalls, but 2 years ago, I was here before this court having a rather lively conversation about the need to replace MSP with an approach that takes into account economies of density. And the board agreed.
It seems like yesterday.
It does, Your Honor. The board agreed at the time that an alternative is warranted, but it didn't like the alternative that the railroads put in because it didn't really capture the economies of density. And this court agreed, but cautioned the agency, if you continue to use this MSP approach, you're on shaky ground. The agency doesn't like being on shaky ground. It prefers nice, solid ground, and the crossover traffic division is an increasingly important part of the overall SAC analysis. So the board exercised its technical expertise and developed an alternative that addressed its and the board, this court's concerns by fixing the flaw in DARA and developing an approach that takes into account economies of density. And the only way you can possibly take into account economies of density, Your Honors, is to look at the average total cost of the various segments. That's the definition of economies of density. An industry enjoys economies of density when its average total cost falls as output goes up. And the reason its average total cost falls is because it's got more traffic over which it can spread the fixed costs. And so the board developed a means of identifying with precision the amount of economies of density for the segment that's being replicated by the SAR and the lighter density portions that tend not to be replicated by the SAR. Its objective was simple. This crossover traffic is used to simplify SAC analysis. The objective was to find a revenue allocation that didn't introduce bias. That was the objective. This crossover traffic was never envisioned by guidelines, Your Honor. The board made it perfectly clear. This is an invention of its own creation subsequent to guidelines. And so so it did not find any conflict with any of the language in guidelines. And it having addressed this issue, this court's precedent in terms of standard of review is you will defer to the agency's interpretation of its guidelines unless it's plainly erroneous. We cite the PPL Montana case for that. There's other cases cited in the PPL case. And it's not plainly erroneous. The questions are different. The fully allocated cost method that the ICC didn't like in 1985 had to do with setting the rate prescription. When you set a rate prescription, you must allocate a specific portion of fixed cost to the issue movement. Here, we're not talking about revenue cost allocations for purposes of rate prescription. We're talking about a revenue allocation, the purpose of which is just to get an unbiased estimate. And the board explained it's not allocating a specific amount to the crossover traffic, like $3.10 or for of the fixed cost. It's just trying to use the average total cost to come up with a reasoned way of addressing economies of density. And so that's sort of a reasoned explanation for why it considered there to be no conflict in guidelines, and this court should defer to the agency's interpretations of its own guidelines, particularly given the direction it offered in the BNSF case that the board find an alternative that took into account economies of density and diminishing margins there too.
Any questions?
No.
Thank you.
When I was up here initially, I didn't get a chance to talk about our fourth issue, which is retroactive application of ATC in the Western Fuels case. It hasn't been addressed at all. I don't know if it's improper rebuttal at this point or not. If it is, I won't.
It was addressed in the briefs, if that's how you want to spend
your okay.
time, right?
Okay. It was addressed in the briefs. One of the key issues for a shipper in a pending case was in the pending case is Western Fuels, is the retroactive application of this new ATC methodology. And coal shippers submit the court should vacate the board's decision to retroactively apply.
And the board put everyone on notice that there was no settled approach here?
I think that's a misnomer. I'm going to give you some facts. Western Fuels modeled its standalone railroad in the winter of 2005. And when you model one of these railroads, you have to figure out, well, how much money am I going to get in? And you have to figure stuff, start modeling, which shippers can contribute what, and then you start saying, how much infrastructure do I need? And it's a complex economic modeling exercise. One of the key components in that is you have to figure out what your crossover traffic divisions are going to be. At the time, Western Fuels was modeling its standalone railroad. In the last nine rate cases, the STB and the ICC had used mileage-based methods. Including in those nine cases were four cases where the agency rejected carrier-sponsored density-based divisions. The only thing that was out there that had been accepted was these mileage-based methods. When shortly after Western Fuels modeled its railroad in the Excel case that was visited about, the board used a mileage-based MSP method to set crossover traffic divisions. It's contemporaneous, more or less, when we're putting our railroad together. And the board appeared before this court and said it was okay to use MSP, which was challenged by the Burlington Northern Railroad, on grounds it was a settled rule. And this court agreed in upholding the board's use of MSP that it was a settled rule. If you were sitting in a room, as we were in 2005, trying to create this railroad, you could not have envisioned ATC density look like it was dead, and you had to come up with something. And so that's what we used. Western Fuels' record was done. We were teed up for a decision when this this rulemaking came out, and the board said, we're going to retroactively apply ATC. And we said, well, no, if you retroactively apply ATC, which was basically set up to ensure that small, high-density railroads, which our little railroad was, wouldn't earn a lot of revenue, and you're switching to a different method, we would have to reconfigure our railroad. And it's notice proposing these rules, the board said, we're not going to require folks to start all over again and reconfigure their railroad. And we said, you're going to make us reconfigure the railroad. The board ignored that in its decision. A year later, when it decided the Western Fuels case, it said, oh, you were right. You know, you would have to reconfigure your railroad. But rather than saying at that point, we won't retroactively apply ATC, it's given the shippers the opportunity to spend several million more dollars to reconfigure our railroad. So we submit that that decision was arbitrary and capricious just as a matter of administrative law. We also believe it's impermissibly retroactive under this court's national mining decision, which as we read it, holds that when an agency promulgates a legislative rule, which was done here, and proposes it to apply in a pending administrative adjudication, in the absence of express statutory authority, the agency cannot retroactively apply the rule where the new rule changes the legal landscape and adversely impacts a party's chances for success on the merits. Here, the change from MSP to ATC was cosmic. It's a completely different methodology. Every party in the proceedings below recognized that we would design a different railroad if we had if we had to use ATC. And the impact was dramatic. Our railroad lost, or the Western Fuels Railroad lost $2.5 billion in revenues. In the decision in Western Fuels, which was about a year after this decision came out, changed from MSP to ATC, $2.5 billion. Our standalone revenues did not exceed the costs. If MSP had applied, the revenues would have exceeded the cost by about $2.4 billion, and they would have had a major victory. But this retroactive change basically took away all of their relief. So we submit it's impermissibly retroactive under national mining. Since I've already used more than my allotted time, I won't make any other points. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I want to go back to the rate prescription issue, the MMM. The agency acknowledges to the court that they have done away with reliance on Ramsey pricing, but they say, that's okay, we're still using some version of differential pricing. And I submit to you that the court has to look very hard at that assertion. First of all, you ought to look at it in the light of this court's 1993 decision in Burlington Northern, where the agency relied on substantially the same argument. That is, we are allowing under our rate methodology, in that case, some differential pricing. Yes, we're capping the highly rated rates at an average of RVC ratios, but we're allowing some differential pricing, so that passes muster under the guidelines. Judge Williams said, no, that variant of Ramsey pricing is Ramsey-like only in the vaguest imaginable sense, namely that it leaves the railroad's lower rates alone. Well, that's exactly what they're doing here. They're leaving the lower rates alone, but they're capping the higher rates. They're capping them based on cost. They say candidly in the decision that cost allocation is the driver of our rate setting under MMM in this decision, and that cannot be consistent with the spirit of the guidelines. They ask the court to rely and basically give carte blanche credibility to a diagram in their decision, which is a complete hypothetical. It's supposed to be a random distribution of RVC ratios. It's not based on any evidence of record. In the record, we have a diagram from one of our witnesses at page 494 of the joint appendix, which shows the pattern of post-prescription rates that MMM produces. And basically, it is a pattern that is completely unrelated to the defendant railroad's pre-existing rate structure. This was based on data in one of the pending rate cases where our expert took the shipper's standalone costs and said, this is the rate prescription pattern you will get under MMM. It's basically a flat line. If you turn to the next page in the JA, he'll show you what the percent reduction method produced in relation to the railroad's pre-existing rate structure.
Thank you, Mr. Seifert. Okay, well, in that case, the case, in that matter, the case is submitted. Gentlemen, thank you all.